Our guest this evening will be introduced by Professor King Kellogg.
Mr. Brannigan, ladies and gentlemen, in my long career up to now, I have introduced just two speakers, and it's been the same speaker both times. If these invitations don't come along a little more frequently than once every 10 years, I'm afraid I won't be able to work in more than perhaps half a dozen or so yet. I don't believe I'll tell you all that I know about Walter de Kloo, because there's always a danger of reciprocation and retaliation. Walter's accomplishments are so numerous and extensive that I'm sure I'll forget some of the important ones, so I'll just aim to mention a few. He holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Munich and is also a graduate of the Vienna School of Music and Art. He's a conductor of many opera performances throughout this country and in several European countries. He conducted the NBC Symphony in 4 concerts. He has been a regular member the past 2 seasons of the Opera News Quiz of the Air, Metropolitan Opera Quiz of the Air, Saturday afternoon broadcast. He has also been a frequent contributor to the Opera News magazine. A distinguished linguist, completely at home in 4 languages, I delight to mention. It is indeed a high privilege to introduce my friend of many years as I speak of this evening, Walter de Kloo.
Well, thank you, Mr. Brannigan. Thank you, King. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You know, before I embark upon discussion of my subject tonight, I have to make a confession. Never before has the mere title of a speech or lecture caused me more of a headache. And why? Well, simply because I had originally intended to call this lecture Music as Propaganda. Now, it so happens that to many of us here, musicians and music lovers alike, the 2 nouns in this title have unquestionably emotional connotations. To us, the word music denotes more than a simple, definite form of human endeavor, comparable, for instance, to engineering or chemistry or any other science or skill which deals with matters and laws of nature and therefore can be called objective. Music, as perhaps the most irrational of arts and therefore the one possessing the most uncontrollable emotional appeal, to us has also deep moral and ethical connotations, just because its very substance defies most of the terms in which we evaluate other forms of human activity. Music, for instance, is neither right nor wrong. It is neither true nor false. It is neither efficient nor inefficient. It is simply good or bad. It is simply beautiful or ugly. And to say whether it's good or bad or beautiful or ugly is not a matter for the critic or for the musicologist or even for the musician to decide. It's a matter to be decided by the listener in ultimate analysis. Now, as strongly positive as is our attitude towards music and its emotional implications, it is equally true that many of us have an instinctively negative attitude towards the emotional implications of the word propaganda. First of all, the term propaganda has been thoroughly discredited by its being so strongly associated with totalitarian governments in this, our 20th century. Almost automatically, it evokes unpleasant memories. It evokes associations of Mr. Goebbels, of pompous mass meetings in Nuremberg or before the Palazzo Venezia in Rome, of loudspeakers blaring Nazi or fascist slogans, of and most recently it denotes the most ruthless attempt to subjugate people's minds into blind cattle-like obedience to the Politburo. But aside from all these extraneous, I might say, historical connotations, the word propaganda per se is apt to rub the psyche of a democratic people just a little bit the wrong way, because it implies some terms which we all feel to be repulsive, a sort of sneaky, half-honest presentation of facts designed to influence people's thinking without actually admitting that this is the aim. We all know that in our daily lives we are subject to a great deal of propaganda in our highly developed advertising, in political speeches, in all sorts of minor ways. And conversely, I venture to say that none of us here has not at one time or another indulged in some kind of subtle propaganda himself, even if it was only putting on a Sunday suit when looking for a job on a weekday, conveying, of course, the idea that we were always dressing so neatly as we did on that particular day. Well, while we make good-natured allowances for this sort of propaganda, it still holds true that we hold a deep-rooted suspicion towards the word. We are apt to say, derogatorily, this isn't the truth, it's just propaganda, meaning not it's a lie, but while some of it may be true, the presentation makes it appear as though it were actually better than it is. And because we are apt to despise cowardly, flabby crookedness even more than outright villainy, we are apt to scorn propaganda even more than the outright lie. Well then, how could I tie the two terms, music and propaganda, together? Wouldn't I defile the one, music, by mentioning it as propaganda? Or could I elevate the term propaganda to be worthy to be mentioned in the same breath as music? Well, for the time being, I'll leave this unanswered, and I simply speak about music and propaganda. And to make myself quite clear, when I speak of propaganda tonight, I mention the word as much as possible without its derogatory connotations. Unfortunately, you see, our language is rather poor in certain respects, and I have long felt that one of the major battles in the Cold War could be won by simply devising finding a one or two syllable word to define good propaganda, a word which would be stronger and more apt than information or campaign of truth or education or enlightenment, all these $64 words that actually, in last analysis, do not convey very much in themselves. Broadly speaking, we shall view music, too, under two basically different aspects. First, on the general basis, as a means, or if you want, as a gimmick to convey emotions or elicit emotional reactions. And second, on a much higher level, as an indicator of the cultural, psychological, sociological level of a given individual, society, period, or nation. And I want to add right away that it is this second aspect which we will scrutinize much more thoroughly than the first. The emotional impact of music is naturally dependent on the receptivity of the listener. Fundamentally, this receptivity is synonymous with ability to hear, because some crude form of reaction to some crude form of music can be found even with the most unmusical human beings. From the dawn of history, rhythmic drum beats could whip savages into frenzied passion, and certain rudimentary melodies could evoke certain individual and collective emotions. Over the centuries, the effectiveness of music as an aid in instilling certain desired emotional states has been considerably developed, and the growth of radio, with its dependence on acoustic devices, has forced the evolution of this development into a formidable technique of musical influence upon a mass audience. This technique uses the latest instrumental and harmonic devices to achieve an infinite variety of shadings, of moods, and of sentiments. It can be It can acoustically depict almost anything, even the fragrance of a sizzling T-bone steak, or anything you want. We have the Voice of America, as every other radio station, major radio station in the country, an almost inexhaustible source of mood music, of all sorts of backgrounds and frames, which we use in our dramatic shows to get our listeners into the mood for a certain dramatic feature or for a certain presentation of the spoken word. Now, these well-calculated musical effects are, of course, no different from that of a stirring brass band introducing the speech of a political candidate, or a drum roll heightening the tension while a trapeze artist prepares for the climax of his number. It would be unfair not to acknowledge that this highly developed kind of musical technique known as mood music, constituting one important aspect of music as, I repeat, as propaganda, it would be unfair to deny that it has presented a most beneficial challenge to many of our composers. And I believe it's necessary to state also that it has not achieved one thing. It has not basically heightened our receptivity to music. On the contrary, I believe it has considerably dulled it. And to give you an example, it has always struck me as miraculous how Plato could mention that certain tonalities in the ancient Greek musical theory were considered unethical and immoral. Now just imagine what intensity of musical reaction must the Greeks have had to consider certain tonalities or to respond to certain tonalities so strongly that these tonalities were considered immoral. I've always myself thought, goodness, I wish once I could sneak off and enjoy the pleasure of a forbidden concert in F sharp or something like that. Well, we could, of course, go into this sort of thing and talk about it for a long time. But, as I've told you, it's the second aspect of music which we will dwell upon much more thoroughly tonight. The music as an indicator of the cultural and sociological state of a time, a period, and a people. When Shakespeare wrote, "If music be the food of love, play on, give me excess of it, that by surfeiting the appetite may sicken and so die," the Bard of Avon quite obviously underrated humanity's almost inexhaustible capacity to absorb music. Because what we experience today is nothing short of an incredible flood of music being unleashed upon our defenseless ears wherever you go. In New York City, you cannot even drink a cup of coffee without having music to go with it. You cannot walk through the streets without hearing some loudspeakers blare through out of motor cars or out of windows or any other place. You simply cannot escape music. I was happy to buy a car without a radio in it because at least it gives me a period of enforced silence on the highway. Now, this music, where does it belong? Where does it stand? Does it in any way reflect our culture? What is it? Where does it come in? How did it get this way? I think if we examine those questions a little bit, we will find some very interesting discoveries. Now, I believe it is true, it corresponds to fact, to say that it is possible to judge a given society by its music life. Thus, music becomes a sort of a window through which an outsider can look into the soul of a given society Just like literature, religion, architecture, or many other aspects. With the general growth of the educational level of the population grew their appreciation of music and soon reached down through all income groups. However, again, a phenomenon took place in music life which proved almost fatal to this development. Namely, we might say music started to split itself down the middle. Once it was a form of artistic endeavor which represented both art and entertainment. But by and by, these two aspects of music grew apart. They became independent of one another. When composers like Berlioz, Wagner, Strauss, Stravinsky, Schoenberg developed the orchestra into a huge, intricate organization of highly skilled virtuosi, they removed art music more and more from the grasp of the individual citizen who just wanted to enjoy music. In modern compositions, it became even impossible to detect the wrong note. And detecting a wrong note is something that gives every audience always that little sting of satisfaction. But you couldn't say anymore, you see? I mean, the public even lost the courage to express its opinion. I mean, the listener, fearful lest he disgrace himself, didn't even dare show his dislike for new works. After all, who wants to be classed with those nitwits who once rejected Beethoven and Bach and so forth, you know? No, they would sit through modern compositions, earnestly trying hard to understand it and to detect a melody, maybe, a rhythmic pattern. And then they would say, well, it's very interesting. Of course, I'm not an expert, I can't say. And then they would take the newspaper and read what the critic had to say and then gauge their opinion after that. On the other hand, we have had a small group which suffered a little bit from what the famous critic once called transitive delusions of grandeur. And those people see greatness in everything uncommon, in everything different. Their only criterion became originality. And every new fad and every queer new combination of tones to them was the work of genius. These people like to think of themselves as unusually progressive. In reality, I suspect they're often just unusually gullible. Well, in short, modern music became less and less of an entertainment to be enjoyed, and more of an issue to be understood. As a result, the bulk of the public, preferring enjoyment to stimulation of its musical intellect, is tenaciously clinging to its favorite of earlier times. As time marches on, the repertory of our orchestras becomes more and more outdated. All over the world, music from the last century still dominates the program. Our large communities, of course, may be able to muster enough sophisticated listeners to fill the hall for contemporary music. But such a group should not be confused with a public at large. Now, this public at large has a perfect right to enjoy music, not only as an art, but also as an entertainment. Now, entertainment in the raw, with little or no pretense at being considered art, is amply provided by our popular musicians, often craftsmen of very high professional qualifications. Now, as art music became less and less entertaining, so entertainment music became less and less artistic. Today, a high percentage of the latter is produced assembly line style without appreciable creative effort. The poverty of their own creative resources led some popular composers to borrowing from the past, swinging the classics and so forth, and the art of instrumental writing is gradually degenerating into the technique of arranging. Yet, we long hairs, we must not forget that these popular musicians fulfill a function as important to our music life as that of the long hairs. not so very long ago, a genius like Mozart could be artist and entertainer at the same time. After the tremendous success of his Figaro in Prague, the composer was invited to a party in that town. The next day, he wrote an enthusiastic report about it to a friend in Vienna, describing how all the fine ladies and gentlemen danced to melodies from Figaro, arranged as minuets and landlers and quadrilles and so forth. Far from being shocked at such a procedure, Mozart regarded it as a great compliment to his music. You all know that Verdi was so sure that La Donna e Mobile would become an instantaneous hit that he forbade the tenor to rehearse it until shortly before the premiere of Rigoletto. He was afraid that Verdi would be accused of stealing a popular song if he gave it out earlier. Well, can you think of any contemporary composer who would be delighted to walk into the Waldorf Astoria and hear his symphony played by Freddie Martin or Benny Goodman? I can. I must say that, to my mind, many of our contemporary most talented composers, by disregarding public taste almost entirely, have left it to the arrangers to fill the need of our generation for musical entertainment. And now, this might shock you. I believe that Arnold Schoenberg has made a lot of friends for Spike Jonze. Now, of course, we must admit that there are many composers, especially here in this country, who have tried and are trying to bridge the tremendous gap that has developed between art music and entertainment music. Theater, ballet, and the movies have offered a more fertile ground for these efforts than the concert hall. And it is precisely in this respect that people like Gershwin, Copland, Menotti, and others have earned considerable significance. Meanwhile, this split between art and entertainment in music has put our interpreters on the spot, too. In order to find a public large enough to support them, they've had to rely primarily on what is called standard repertory. In playing the old masterworks over and over again, our younger soloists expose themselves to an ever-increasing degree to comparison with older and more famous colleagues whose interpretations of these same works are constantly heard over the air in our concert halls. How much longer will the public enjoy another and still another young pianist in the Tchaikovsky concerto? How much longer will it continue to buy another and still another recording of the same concerto? Go to another performance of Rigoletto. Go to another performance of Traviata. Let us not be deceived by the rapid increase in cultural consciousness of the public and by the fact that there are still quite a few communities where Heifetz and Rubinstein haven't played the Brahms concerto yet, and where a Chopin concerto is still a relative novelty. By now, almost the entire standard repertory has been recorded many times over, and by outstanding artists. How much longer will a live performance of these works be more attractive than a recorded one by one of the world's top artists under the finest possible conditions with no flaws? I know that we say the live performance still has something, it does, I'm agreeable, but I think we are bound, sooner or later, to be forced into a new repertory, and I must say I personally do not see this new repertory as such forthcoming, although I know a few works are getting into the repertory gradually, but there are many too few in order to really make up, keep in step with the time as it advances. I must say, those who disagree with this pessimistic viewpoint are likely to point to the fact that the film has not eliminated the theater, as had been predicted by many. However, the basic difference is this. Fortunately, our theater does not know the word repertory, but is being kept alive by the production of new works, by the quality and timeliness of the output of our playwrights. Broadway very seldom sees a revival, except in cases where a well-known work might serve as a vehicle for some famous actor, or where the revived work may be assumed to be new to a substantial majority of the public. The lack of a repertory theater may be deplored because it deprives an interested minority of the public of the chance to see some of the masterworks of our literature. But it should be borne in mind that it was precisely the lack of repertory to which we owe the masterworks of Shakespeare. He had to write new plays in order to keep his company going. He couldn't fall back on the tested chestnuts of a repertory that was there. Similarly, Joseph Haydn had to write new symphonies for his employer, because if he had ever repeated a symphony, his employer would probably have said, well, what's the matter with you? Didn't you have time to write me a new symphony? I've heard this before. I want to hear something new. You see how entirely different those times were? I think that the word repertory and what it stands for is responsible for a great many of the problems which beset our music life of today. Yet, how can we get away from it? Any symphony conductor or opera director will resignedly say, well, all right, I'd like to do something new, but how in heaven am I going to find the money for rehearsals? For without rehearsals, I can't do new works. And by saying so, he puts his finger, of course, on what seems to be the main problem of our contemporary music life, money. I say scene. Because, strangely enough, I refuse to consider the problem of money a very startling or a very new problem. It does not dismay me in the least to realize that art cannot pay for itself. It never could. Furthermore, I do not believe that music was ever supported for the sake of music alone, save perhaps in certain very, very rare instances of almost superhuman generosity on the part of some individual. And I do not believe that music loses any of its dignity by being supported for an extra musical purpose. As a matter of fact, I think in the overwhelming majority of cases it was. And it is precisely our main job today to find an extra musical purpose for which to support music. Let me make myself clear. In all periods of its greatest heights, music performed a specific function within the life of a community or of a dominating segment of this community. In other words, music had a forum, F-O-R-U-M, where it presented itself to the world and to posterity, where it embodied the noblest aspirations of the time. In the Middle Ages, this forum was the church. The church in itself has nothing to do with music, but it inspired the greatest masters of musical creation to devote their genius to the service of the church. In the Renaissance, this forum was provided by the court. Who cares today about the questionable moral climate of some of these courts, as long as it brought forth the masterworks it did, growing like flowers in a swamp? Later, in the time of Baroque and Rococo, it was the aristocracy who provided the main forum for the growth and development of the fine arts. And still later, it was the upper bourgeoisie, taking over from the aristocracy, which offered the platform on which music life could blossom. Now, this does not mean that in all these periods there was no music life outside of what I have called the forum. On the contrary, there was a great deal of it. Yet, the above-mentioned, agencies, if I may call them so, the church, the court, the aristocracy, the bourgeoisie, were the pillars of communal life. And, as such, the most important centers of all cultural activity. Now, and this is important, it is not true that their interest in music was inspired only by sheer love of music as such. It was due to a great extent to the extra musical connotations of musical practice.
Music
undoubtedly heightens the solemnity of a church service. It is immaterial. Whether the Bishop of Reims, for instance, was a music lover, or whether he, for reasons of personal prestige, hired a great organist to outdo the Bishop of Rouen. It is immaterial whether the court of Venice just loved opera, or whether it established an opera house only because it did not want to be shamed by the court of Florence, which already had one. Who cares whether Tycoon A leaves $1 million for a symphony orchestra because he loves music, or whether he's stone deaf and hates the highfalutin stuff, but he wants to show that he can do better than this his arch enemy Tycoon B, who left $800,000 in a neighboring city for the same purpose.